Good morning, everyone. So I work in an epidemiology department, so the idea of fluidity is not something people are familiar with in our department. So I'm going to give you some numbers that are based on the best knowledge that we have right now. At the top of the slide, you'll see three definitions that I'll be using throughout the course of my 15 minutes. And I use the word transgender or trans to refer to people whose current gender identity differs from the sex they were assigned at birth. Genderqueer to refer to people whose identity is neither entirely male or female or a combination of both. And I think for younger people, the term gender variant is used more often, and I think among adults I hear genderqueer, adolescents, genderqueer used more often for people who are not going to necessarily select male or female. And then cisgender is a term that's used to refer to people who are not transgender. So in, I think it was June or July of 2016, The Lancet had a special issue on transgender health. And in that special issue, Winter et al. Really pulled together all the data that was available at the time on the numbers of transgender people around the world and came up with a global estimate of about 25 million transgender people worldwide. And then, as Aaron recently referred to, the Williams Institute collated data from about 30 states in the United States that asked the question about people's transgender identity and estimated that there are about 1.4 million transgender identified people in the United States. And that makes up about 0.6% of the population. The caveat is, as Aaron has mentioned, how you count makes a difference in the number that you're going to get, right? So some of these studies ask questions about people who are getting hormone therapy. Some ask about whether they had a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. Some ask self-report. I would argue that the most accurate number that you get is self-report, because just like children know who they are, adults also know who they are. So there are recommendations for best practices on how to ascertain transgender status, especially for research or programmatic evaluation. It's true that not everyone that falls under what we would call the transgender umbrella identifies as transgender. There are people who, once they have achieved a transition or are living in the gender that aligns with their identity, they no longer feel that the word transgender applies to them. They're simply a man or simply a woman. So if you want to understand how many people have a transgender experience, the current best practice is to use a two-step model. So the first question would be, what is someone's current gender identity? And they would get options beyond male and female. They might get the options trans male, trans female, gender queer, or additional categories, as you see on the slide here. And then the second question would be, what sex was the person assigned at birth? And currently in the United States, we don't have options on the birth certificate other than male or female. Even if someone's born with a difference of sexual development, usually the birth certificate says male or female. So if someone identifies as transgender, or if there's a difference between the sex they were assigned at birth and their current gender identity, then they can fall under that transgender umbrella. And it does make a difference how you count. So you see the bar chart on the right has a slide that's taken from CDC HIV testing event data. And in the bar chart that's, I hope it's to your left, it's to my left, you can see what the number of trans people who had HIV testing events in the CDC data using the one-step model, where they simply asked the first question, what is your gender identity? And it was about 12,000 people. Once they started using the two-step model, where they asked both questions, you can see that there were about 21,000 trans people who participated in HIV testing events. And that makes a big difference in terms of reporting statistics and understanding the programmatic and the HIV and STI prevention needs of the community. Oh, that's nice. Help. I know what my next slide is, but this is completely blank. I just pressed the forward arrow. Oh, good. I just pressed a different button. It all works. So it's also important to remember that gender identity is different from sexual orientation. I really appreciated Aaron's slide with all the arrows around gender and about gender identity and around sexual orientation. And it's important to remember that transgender people can have any sexual orientation. There used to be a time where if somebody went to a healthcare provider seeking genital reconstruction surgery or transition-related care, that if they were not going to transition and end up being a heterosexual person, then they were denied the ability to transition. This hopefully is no longer true in most places, and this data that you see on the slide here is taken from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey that was conducted in about 2008-2009. And there were over 6,000 participants in this survey around the United States, 6,000 trans identified people. And they were asked about their sexual orientation. And you can see from the pie chart that people's sexual orientation span the spectrum. So it's important not to make assumptions about sexual orientation or sexual behavior based on somebody's gender identity. So going back to the CDC data around HIV testing among transgender people, this is data that was reported, I think it was published last year, and it's testing data from 2009 to 2011 where they ask about transgender status using that two-step method that we described. And what you see is that new HIV positive test results were highest among trans people. So the new positive results were about 0.9% among cisgender males, 0.2% among cis females, and 2.4% among trans people. And that was not equally distributed by gender trajectory. So if you're looking at trans feminine people, so people who identify as trans people who identify as women or along a feminine spectrum, you can see the percentage was 2.7, whereas trans masculine people was 0.5. So there is definitely a disparity in what we know about HIV positive test results by gender spectrum. And then the highest rates of HIV that we see are among trans women of color. And this shouldn't be surprising given that we know that there is enormous racial disparities in HIV prevalence and HIV test positivity in the United States writ large. This is also true in trans communities. So now I'm going to provide what we know, which is very little, on HIV and STIs among trans men and then what we know among trans women. So in the upper left-hand corner, you can see the data that we pulled from a recent systematic review where we looked at all the data from 2012 to 2015 among trans men and HIV in the United States. And there were six studies that had laboratory-confirmed HIV prevalence. And you can see the rates range from a low of about 0.5% to a high of about 4%. With the caveat, if you look at the bottom, I don't know if you can even see this, but the studies that had 3, 4, 5% prevalence were small studies with usually samples of less than 100 people. So that 3, 4, and 5% usually represent one or two people in the entire study sample. Whereas the sample that had over 2,000 people had a prevalence of about 0.5%. So we think that's probably more accurate about what we see in terms of HIV among transmasculine individuals writ large. There's very limited data on STIs among trans men. You can see here I listed the two studies where there are data. Both of them have small samples, 123 and 169. And laboratory confirmed STIs was 8.7% in the community clinic sample, remembering that's 23 people, so that means about two people. And then in the STI clinic, you can see the range of proportions from 1.5 if we're talking about syphilis to as high as 4.4 if we're talking about anal GC. Which brings us to the point where I pull together the gender identity and the sexual orientation spectrum. So as we think about HIV risk among transmasculine individuals, we need to think about the fact that some transmasculine individuals are attracted to other men, including cisgender men, and that means that they are at the same risk of HIV, if not higher, as other men who have sex with men. And it's important to consider them if you're doing work with men who have sex with men and around HIV and STI prevention. And in fact, there was a recent study that was published, a qualitative study among 19, I think it was 18 or 19 transmasculine individuals who were asked about any changes in their sexual orientation and their attractions and behavior as they underwent hormone therapy with testosterone. And most of the participants in this qualitative study reported some shifting in their sexuality, not only increase in their sexual frequency, so the number of times that they had sex and the number of partners, but also an increase in their partnerships with males. We look at the data on HIV and STIs in trans women. There's much more data globally. Our team at Hopkins did a global HIV meta-analysis of laboratory-confirmed HIV that went through the year 2011. If we pull out the data from the United States, there was a prevalence of about 22% in trans women. And if we think about that in the context of the general population in the United States, where the HIV prevalence is less than 1%, you can see that's an enormous disparity. And in fact, it's 34-fold higher than the general population. We recently did an update systematic review looking at data in the last 3 years since that previous study was published, and we saw that there was a similarly high prevalence of HIV that had not changed, but we looked at a little more detail at subpopulations of transgender women who might be at highest risk, and we saw that 40% of the HIV prevalence was among transgender women of color, that it was 4.5% among youth 16 to 24 years, and in fact, I believe that if we're going to prevent HIV and STIs, that we need to start early and young. And we noticed that the there were some incident estimates. So not just how many people are living with HIV, but how many new infections are there over time, and it was a remarkably high 2.9 per 100 person years. You also see the STI incidence rates listed here, where you can see the range of about 2.4 to 4.2 in one study, and then another cross-sectional study with over 200 participants showing a range of as high as 6.5% of anal GC to a low of 0% of urogenital, and some of that relates to sexual behavior, so that's going to be important to find out as well. I won't go over this because I just got the five-minute warning, but the most important column is this piece in the middle that I want to focus on when we look at biological and then social risk for HIV among trans people. So there are questions that remain and some minimal information that we know about the impact of hormones on HIV and STI risk. There's some questions about whether there's interactions with PrEP in terms of concentration of tenofovir in the colon compared to the vagina. There's impacts on sexual behavior, especially among trans men that we've already talked about. There's questions about the risk of HIV acquisition in the neo-vagina and the impact of genital surgery for trans men who have sex with men in terms of sexual behavior and risk. And many trans women in particular inject silicone or other soft tissue fillers for feminization of the body, and there's questions about whether that affects inflammation and that affects HIV risk or disease progression, and whether or not contaminated equipment is a factor in HIV acquisition. I could spend all day talking about social and structural risk associated with HIV vulnerability, but if we think about partner pools and sexual networks that might be available for trans people, given the societal discrimination against trans people, limiting their partner pool and maybe limiting the power to negotiate in sexual relationships, limited employment opportunities due to discrimination, leading to high rates of sex work, challenges in housing discrimination leading to transience, and mental health and substance abuse issues related to minority stress that also are associated with reduced condom use. I wanted to just highlight this great document that came out last year looking at PrEP in trans populations. While the CDC guidelines don't mention trans people in particular, they do. PrEP is approved for any population at high risk for HIV, and the IAS USA guidelines recommend PrEP in any community where there's greater than 2 per 100 person years prevalence of incidence of HIV, and we know that trans people, specifically trans women, meet that criteria. Barriers to PrEP tend to be lack of inclusive marketing, concerns in the community about hormone interactions with PrEP, and a history of medical mistrust and avoidance due to lots of data I could show you on discrimination in healthcare settings. Facilitators include trans competent services, so having a healthcare provider that understands trans people's experiences and needs, and having an empowerment approach to how we think about STI and HIV prevention. So instead of what you should do, here's a toolbox available to you that you can use to protect your health. It's a very different approach. And unfortunately, we have no available data on PrEP in trans men. I am happy to note that the first PrEP demonstration projects in the United States to focus exclusively on transgender people were awarded in the spring 2016 by the California HIV/AIDS Research Program. These demonstration projects are in San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and the plan is to include 700 transgender women and men and focusing on transgender people of color. Their goal is to design and implement novel, tailored interventions that increase uptake and adherence to PrEP and to investigate potential drug interactions with PrEP. So we'll have some answers to that hopefully in the coming years. The downside I see to that is we're all in Atlanta. We know that the burden of HIV in particular is in the South, and so this data will be coming out of a very different cultural context than what we see here. So just in case I had to speed through, I wanted to be able to land on my key messages side, is that trans people face significant vulnerability to HIV and STIs, and that gender-affirming care improves access to an uptake of prevention and care services, and there are resources available to guide competent services. And since I didn't have time to talk about that, I wanted to point you to some resources. I don't know if you'll have access to these slides, but I'm happy to send them to you if you want to email me afterwards. The Transit is an implementation guide for HIV and STI programs in transgender people. It's on the United Nations Development Program website, and our own Dr. Radix was one of the key authors of the services section, so I recommend that. The UCSF Center of Excellence for Transgender Health has primary care protocols available on their website, as well as a learning center. And the CDC has several really excellent campaigns on addressing HIV in trans communities. This is a picture here of the Lancet that I mentioned to you, the special issue that came out in July. Also, the Journal of International AIDS Society had a special issue focused on HIV epidemics globally, and JADES had a special issue that came out in August on HIV prevention and trans communities. And finally, there's a list of guidelines and tools that are globally and locally available. And also the community itself has created materials that they use to help promote their own health. And I think it's important to be aware of that because community-led and generated interventions are usually going to be more, acceptable, that's what I was looking for, acceptable to the community. Menopause, it's something, I tell you. So here's my contact information, and I look forward to the question and answer period.